Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Esteban Reyes joins us today from Miami. He's the founder and CEO of Zynda Capital, a firm that supports founders in the U.S. and LATAM who are creating the software layer for the new economy. Esteban has spent the last two decades building and investing in companies that use software and data to transform underserved and emerging industries. He has a successful track record of co-founding and exiting companies in fintech, software, and consumer. And since 2016, he's been a professional investor in early stage startups and VC funds, achieving a personal track record of over 6x capital invested. Esteban, it's great to have another Kaufman Fellow and Emerging Manager combo on the show. So welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thanks for the invite, Ty. Super excited to be here.
Awesome. Well, we always start, I gave my snippet of your background, but give us that color commentary on your journey and, you know, ultimately why you decided to jump off and launch Zynda Capital.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Colombia, and I come from a family of coal miners, and that legacy has been a major source of inspiration for me and everything that I've done. So in the 1940s, my grandfather, he was working at a mine, and he thought about ways to better improve the trajectory of his own life and his family. So he found a way to get to the U.S. and landed a job at an oil and gas company. There, he went through ropes. He learned the business. He took a position in sales. And then eventually, after spending there 6 or 7 years and becoming an executive, he came back to Colombia and became an entrepreneur in the oil and gas space. So that story has always inspired me. I always wanted to be an entrepreneur myself. And when I came to the U.S. myself in the late 90s to go to college, during my junior year, I spent a lot of time working in the financial industry as a part-time job. And I identified a number of opportunities, particularly around verifying information for borrowers. Thought it was very slow, very antiquated, no real sort of technologically driven process behind it. And taught myself how to code, and I ended up launching my first company as part of that, which is called Verification Bureau. So that company was very successful. That product was used by over 400 banks across the U.S., still being used today. And in 2009, after the financial crisis, fraud became a very prevalent thing and something that, you know, was not only the thing that banks wanted to prevent, but it was mandated now by regulation. So we started to get acquisition offers, and we ended up selling the company to LPS, which is now Black Knight. So this is a publicly traded company. It's the largest technology and services provider in the mortgage space. And that was my foray into startups. So from there, you know, I was at LPS, Black Knight, for a few years, helping them integrate the company across their enterprise. Decided that I didn't want to be a corporate executive for too long, so I went back to starting companies. This time around, I did it a little bit different. Started hanging out with a lot of other founders and got excited about their ideas. Had a little bit of cash from the exit, so essentially was running a one-man show venture studio, incubating companies partnered with founders, but using my own capital. The common thread was software and data. And I don't know if it was intuition, intrinsic motivation, or luck, but a lot of those were in underserved industries. So, for example, we did some stuff in education, we did stuff in B2B commerce, and, you know, realized that there is a massive opportunity in helping a lot of these industries transform by applying modern technology. So in 2016, decided to jump into the investment side more formally. Help launch another firm, and the focus then was in the Southeast U.S., still following, you know, a B2B software focus investment strategy. Learned a lot about VC through that process. And then in 2021, kind of went back to my grassroots and realized that now more than ever, investing in underserved industries that have the opportunity to modernize is a very exciting opportunity. So therefore, launched the firm, and I guess here we are.
Right on. Well, having roots back in, you know, the ethos of this podcast, digital industrial, mining and mining coal, that's certainly where you come from, an appreciation for the domain. So we're going to dig in much more on that here in a second. But maybe just to set the stage for the listeners, tell us a little more high level data points about Zenda Capital generally and the fund mandate so they know when they reach out.
Yep, absolutely. So as I mentioned, we launched in 2021. We spent the last 12 to 14 months fundraising, hence we were in stealth. However, we've assembled a team of five people, including myself. So Jeff Dong, he runs our research and investment process, which I'll talk more about later in the podcast. And then we have Chetan Chaudhary, Evan Kumak, who were early executives at Twilio. They bring a very deep domain knowledge of technical products as well as go-to-market, which we believe is a crucial aspect in underwriting companies that are looking to transform industries. And then lastly, Sol Franco, who runs all of our back office operations. So we're a small, nimble, but very effective team. We're targeting a portfolio of about 15 to 20 companies. So it's a fairly concentrated strategy, and that's by design. Our first checks range from $500K up to $1 million. Generally in pre-seed and seed stage companies, which is loosely defined. In the end, we call them pre-product market fit companies. And from there, we're looking to follow on the best performing companies without any preconceptions. And we will follow on through IPO if we have the opportunity, whether it is through sidecar vehicles or SPVs. And then we think the opportunity where we have the best ability to be effective is in the US and LATAM. No specific sort of definition of how much in the US, how much in LATAM. We're really just covering the Americas and, you know, following the best founders. The last thing I'll say is we're flexible on the role. We can lead rounds, and we've led rounds successfully. Over 80% of the rounds that we've led have received follow-on capital from funds that most people would consider top-tier Series A, Series B investors. However, we understand that there are situations where maybe we're better suited to participate in a round. The only thing that we care about is being part of the journey of the best founders and being able to collaborate with them closely.
Right on. Well, let's dig in more on the thesis underneath the fund. And, you know, with Zenda's first fund recently announced, that pre-seed seed stage focus initially, where, to quote, we want to help founders bring cutting edge technology to underserved industries in the US and LATAM, all things you've mentioned so far already. So let's go a little deeper. And you gave us some of the story, but, you know, give us a little bit more of that context behind launching Zenda. How you identify what you call underserved areas of the economy, and ultimately why you wanted to create the fund to back those founders who are, again, to use your quote, redefining overlooked industries. Let's go a layer deeper on that.
Yeah, so the first thing is, if you look at the global market top down, it's very easy to notice that there's very little market cap attributable to modern software and AI technology companies that are serving legacy industries. That, you know, has been the case for a long time. So the question is, why now? We believe that the advances in modern software, and I guess more recently, it's been top of mind, machine learning and AI, are such where implementing these technologies is actually viable. Historically, the problem has been that there's very little data interoperability across systems in these legacy industries. There's very sort of limited ability to extract data and make that data usable. And therefore, you know, it's hard to propose a rip and replace solution because, you know, most companies have made significant investments and integrations in order to have the systems that they have today. But we believe now these advances that I referenced make a big difference. So that's at a fundamental level. Why? Then if you look at the evolution of computing, you'll see that, you know, in the 1990s, it was all about the internet. 2000s was about mobile. 2010s was sort of like laying the foundation of big data, AI, and ML. We believe the 2020s are going to be about the verticalization of software, but more importantly, AI, ML. You look at industries like financial services, huge TAM, you know, $22 trillion, supply chain and transportation, $8 to $10 trillion, healthcare, similar order of magnitude, agriculture, similar story. And you ask yourself, you know, why haven't these industries transformed yet outside of the technological constraints? We believe it's also a question of market pull and consumers or players in their supply chains not really having modernized themselves or having those requirements of more sort of efficient and effective processes. We now think that the cat's out of the bag and that there's enough of a market pull for players to change the way they've been doing things. That doesn't mean that it's going to be easy. There's still some sort of challenges in getting companies and players in these industries to adopt new technologies. But we believe that it is ripe, and we believe that the next 10 to 20 years, it's, you know, multi-trillion dollar opportunity to focus on these markets, which is why we're sort of decided to make it the main pillar for Zendo.
Right on. Well, you know, we're biased fans here. We share our investment with our guys down in Mexico City at Solvento, and I think most people would appreciate, right, reshoring, nearshoring. Of course, there's a lot of buzz and a lot of recalibrating supply chains, moving a lot of freight. But to your point, even some of those, why now? Internet penetration in Mexico is growing at an all-time rate. E-commerce growth isn't slowing down there. So there's all these structural things that you and I both see that financial services and trucking as Solvento, again, a nice plug for those guys. I think the timing is spot on. So love the thesis there. And Esteban, one of the things I wanted to tack on here to be a little more tactical about the making an investment decision side of this, you know, when you really are going that earliest pre-seed stage in some of these underserved industries, however we define it, what are you really looking for? You know, because it's tough, like you said, logistics, construction, agriculture, legacy industries. What does it take at that earliest pre-seed stage to get you guys excited?
Yeah. Investing in these categories, from our perspective, requires combining multiple disciplines, and that is what makes it challenging. So first, you've got to have some level of industry insight and understanding of the problems that, you know, you want to invest behind. The way that we do it at Zenda is by taking a research-first approach. And what we do is apply similar frameworks as we did when we were founding and operating companies. So things like customer development, value proposition testing. And it's a function of talking to operators, potential customers, founders in the specific industries. We spend a fair amount of time doing that, and we have a process for how we do it. So every quarter or so, we're running a sprint focused on a specific industry in order to develop a point of view in specific problem spaces within that industry that we like. So, for example, we recently published a paper in B2B payments and lending infrastructure in LATAM. So there's a level of specificity there where we try to tease out what are the different opportunities, why is there an opportunity, and what are the different frameworks that could be used to sort of underwrite companies that are building in that category. So that's number one. Number two, and by the way, I should mention that we're not trying to be smarter than founders by doing that or anybody else. We're just trying to develop an independent point of view that helps us in making decisions. And also in doing that, building a network that we can leverage to help portfolio companies.
Right. Kind of so, like the prepared mind, right? Bring it to the table, but the founders are always going to see it before us, or at least that's my opinion.
Exactly. Exactly right. Then the other thing is, we believe that we need to intimately understand the different technologies that can drive change, and you know, understand how it can actually be applied in a specific problem. Like AI gets thrown around a lot. AI is not the answer to everything. I mean, I hate the term AI. It's just presumptuous. It ultimately is, you know, math, right? And mm-hmm. compute power. Understanding the limitations and sort of how the trends of the evolution of those technologies are actually relevant in the specific industries. And then lastly, developing sensitivity around product vision and go-to-market. We believe that oftentimes in these industries, you require a multi-product strategy in order to fully capture the opportunity. Because TAMs, while I quoted very large TAMs a little bit ago, sometimes the value capture is not, you know, as large as a horizontal play, for example. So while you still at the beginning require like a very well-defined product thesis and, you know, why you're solving a very specific problem and how you're going to solve it in order to drive adoption, right? Because you can't try to boil the ocean. You still need to have a bigger sort of very well thought out vision of how that initial product is going to evolve in a relatively short period of time. And we think that as investors, you can't just rely on what founders are telling you. If you're trying to focus on a specific industry, you got to have your own point of view in order to be able to either align with the founder vision or have a different perspective. And then another example is around sensitivities of product and go-to-market is, for example, monetization. As you know, in these industries, isn't always like we're building software and then selling it as a service. Sometimes the value can't be captured that way, and you got to capture it by layering things like getting into the payments flow or offering other financial products like lending, insurance, and so on. And even that sort of framework isn't cookie cutter, isn't something you can just, you know, take from one industry and apply it to the other. You got to understand why would those products be valuable to the specific customers and how does that sort of allow you to capture value better than some other monetization strategies. So I guess in summary, we think that every market and every company is different. And it's important for us at Zenda to understand not only the market, but also how the specific product that is being brought to market is sort of going to be monetized and is going to evolve over time in order to build a very big company.
Right on. Well, it's an incredibly transparent answer, and it's part of the reason this podcast exists. All the founders out there listening, you know exactly what Esteban and them are going to be looking for, and I think it's a great diligence outlook how you guys are going to evaluate the opportunity. So appreciate you sharing that. And you know, the next topic I want to cover, we've mentioned a few times, but really that focus you guys do have on LATAM as well. And so, you know, the Zenda thesis is, again, at the intersection of modernizing underserved industries across the U.S. and LATAM. And you and your team have done some significant research in the area, which you've chosen to open source some of this, including this recent study you mentioned. I'll title it again, Digital B2B Payments and Lending Infrastructure in LATAM. I'll definitely put this in the show notes so everyone can find it here, too. But the question building up here, you know, in this geographic and sector sweet spot, which I do think is pretty differentiated amongst VC firms, what are some of those unique economic, technological, political, and, you know, any other factors you frequently have to work through when evaluating deals in LATAM and also supporting those companies in this universe? And if I could also ask, you know, what are some of those lessons learned you've learned since kicking off Zenda Capital about what it takes to scale and win in these markets with those other dynamics behind them?
Yeah, so I'll share some thoughts specific to, you know, B2B payments and lending in LATAM. But obviously there's broader considerations that are outside of that specific thesis. So when you look at what percentage of companies in LATAM are classified as SMEs, it's basically 9 out of 10. They're producing about 60% of formal productive employment in the region, yet they lack capital and they lack sort of the ability to grow for that same reason. COVID accelerated some secular tailwinds around digitization of B2B payments, particularly in e-commerce and in fintech, as well as in some other industries. So that was really helpful for the region. But still, 55% of B2B payments are made in cash in LATAM. And we believe that this represents at about 1.4 trillion opportunity for SMEs if you can digitize most of those payments and also enable access to cash. So with that as backdrop, you know, what are the things to consider from, as you said, political, economic, social, cultural, and technological perspectives? So, you know, governments are definitely looking to replace cash for more efficient, lower cost, traceable payment solutions. A very good example is CFDI in Mexico, which, you know, maybe Pix in Brazil is a better example. You know, the inflection and the level of adoption there has been quite phenomenal, and almost like a case study for other governments to piggyback off. And CFDI is sort of, you know, slower, but tracking behind that. So I think from a political standpoint, there is support for things like this. But when you go to countries like Colombia, you'll find that there's, you know, a stronger, sort of more opinionated regulator, trickier to get a product off the ground. So you got to be aware of, you know, LATAM is not one single place. Every country has their own different frameworks, even though they're starting to converge to some extent. But you got to think about if you're going to build a business like this in LATAM, first, in order to be venture scale, more often than not, needs to be multi-country. Then, you know, being aware of what are the constraints from a regulatory standpoint is critical. From an economic standpoint, I mean, we think that other than Brazil, Spanish speaking LATAM is pretty homogeneous as far as like demographics. So that is a plus in the sense that it's not that what works in Mexico works in Colombia, but there's usually some portability from like, say, a cultural standpoint. And then technologically, you mentioned earlier that there has been widespread internet and mobile connectivity penetration across the region. You know, we don't think that trend is going to stop. That's immutable. And things like better infrastructure for building region-specific products is, you know, getting built as we speak. There's a number of teams that have been sort of the old guard of the first technology wave that are now pushing themselves to build more technical products, whereas maybe the first wave of technology in LATAM was more about, you know, marketplaces, fintech, and SaaS. Now you're kind of starting to see some pretty deep technology plays, which we think is very exciting because, again, they're building for the region. So that infrastructure is becoming available. So yeah, those are some of the things that we thought about as far as like this specific thesis. Now, in terms of the region itself, like what are the things to consider as an investor? I mean, certainly what I said before, it's a multi-country, multi-jurisdiction play. So really understanding what that means from an investor perspective is like table stakes. And then from there is, you know, there's a different liquidity profile in the region than, say, more mature markets like the U.S. We actually think that's very exciting because, you know, we believe that the risk return profile aligns with a different liquidity profile in this particular case. But it's not for everybody. Right. And then the last thing is there are a lot of nuances when you're operating in the region. And even though, you know, as an investor, you're really relying on the founding teams that you're backing to operate. If you want to be helpful, if you want to be involved, you know, you're taking a board seat or whatever, like you really got to understand what those nuances are in order to be most effective, or at least have people around the table that can complement, you know, the perspective that an investor that doesn't have that experience may bring, but may have other experiences that are equally valuable.
It's a great rundown of each of those different aspects. And, you know, maybe if it's an unfair question, is there any like one thing, you know, maybe less than the obvious, recruit great team members around you, it's always core, but is there any like one thing you've seen from a scaling motion that any of your portfolio companies have done to really jump off the back of all those variables you mentioned and actually start winning the market?
Yeah, I think it's, at least for me, it's hard to encapsulate it in to one thing other than what you already said.
Sure.
Maybe I would extrapolate that a little bit, or I would expand that a little bit by saying having local teams across each country, you know, or jurisdiction that you're trying to expand that have domain expertise has really catalyzed growth. I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything groundbreaking, but as simple as it is, that has proven to work, right? At least in the companies that I'm involved in that have successfully expanded across the region.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point to tease out because having boots on the ground domain experience is critical. And certainly I can only agree with you. That's the only way we've seen it been able to scale. So like that, and maybe it's a little bit of a different topic per se, but I want to wrap up some of our big discussion here, talking about what it means to be an emerging manager today. We both obviously focus on a lot of these underserved industries, but we're still, you know, day to day, me and you building firms with our partners. So in a thoughtful piece you wrote back in 2020, actually for Kauffman Fellows, you described why we've seen so many new emerging managers enter venture over the past few years. And at the time you wrote that article, I think the data was there was more than 900 micro VC firms, which was up from about 100 in 2012. So a 9x increase in just 7 years when you wrote the post. And we know that, yes, there's been some moderation in the growth of new emerging managers over the past year with all the recalibration going on. But I can only guess the number of emerging managers only accelerated since 2020 when that piece came out. And then you go on to point out that the conditions have been ripe for new emerging managers to enter as specialist firms, a lot of what you've been talking about on the pod today, that could better support these founders at the earliest stages in their respective areas of focus and, you know, ultimately to improved outcomes for those startups. So all that build up, tell us more about why you feel that new specialist emerging managers are so critical to the evolution of the VC ecosystem. And then drilling down, you know, take us through that perspective, what it's like to be a new fund manager in 2023 right now with all the challenges that we're all facing to help build a long-term enduring franchise and identify those next, shall I say, Solventos again, to give those guys a plug. So give us the color on the emerging manager ecosystem in your view.
I would say that there's different strategies for different people. So when I wrote that article, admittedly, it was coming from through my own point of view, or I was expressing my own point of view. So the reason I'm saying that is because it's not that I don't believe that a generalist firm can't be successful. And they're certainly very successful early stage emerging generalist firms. But that said, my opinion is, I think that investing at the early stage is as much of, you know, art and science. And what I mean by that is understanding the industries or the problem spaces that you're investing in very intimately. Like a lot of things I mentioned before, is at the core of, you know, what we believe will make us successful at Zenda. And the reason is because you got to be able to invest in things that you deeply understand, especially when there's a lot of capital in the market that is chasing deals. And even in this market, I don't think that's changed. There's a lot of committed capital still, and you know it will get deployed. So if you don't have a perspective, if you haven't studied a market, if you haven't studied an industry, and the only way you can really do that is if you're specializing, whether you're working at a big firm and you specialize in some domain, or your whole fund specialized in that domain, doesn't matter, but you got to be able to have a perspective. We think that in the past 10 years, being an investor was a lot easier, you know, pre-2021. There was a bull market, there was a lot of momentum. Maybe just having simple heuristics like strong founding teams, some early traction and customer validation was enough. We don't think that's the case moving forward. We think that picking is probably going to be the most important thing. So that's where I was coming from. I guess that's maybe revealing that I've been thinking about that for a while since the article was published. I believe it was in 2020. So that's one aspect of it. The other is, I think that establishing a network in a specific category or area of interest is also the best way of bringing leverage and options to founders beyond whatever your own firm can provide. And if you're an emerging manager, if you're early in sort of building your franchise, you probably have limited resources. So how do you amplify that? By, you know, bringing a network to the table. And it's really hard to build a network across all categories, unless it's something, you know, that is, in my opinion, fairly commoditized, which is access to downstream capital or access to some type of general advice. With all of that put together is why sort of I believe that having some level of specialization is important in order to be successful as an investor and also in order to build a durable franchise.
Agree. No one right way to build a venture firm, but I do really appreciate, obviously, a lot of alignment with our shop. It does help to have those networks that prepared mine around the markets and themes you want to focus on it. And I think founders benefit from it too. Lots of ways to do that, of course. So maybe then we always love to bring the podcast back to those folks in the arena, the founders specifically at some point. And you've already given them a lot of words of wisdom on what you're going to be looking for when you evaluate, but maybe just to kind of succinctly say, any words of wisdom you'd have for them as they think about raising capital or approaching Zynda from like a, hey, keys to success when you enter the chat, or a common challenge pitfall to avoid when they approach.
You mean specific to fundraising?
Yeah, when they're thinking about spooling up a raise and, you know, maybe thinking about Zynda Capital as that partner for them.
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, I'll start with the very basics, hopefully not too basic, but yeah, just come fully prepared, and not specific to Zynda, just in general when you're going out to raise, meaning have whatever data you think could be useful for investors to make a decision readily available in, you know, an easily distributable and consumable format. Be prepared for a lengthier process than maybe, you know, we saw in the 2020-2021 cycle. People are taking their time, it's what we're seeing, and that's probably healthy. And more importantly, I mean, I think a lot of both investors and founders during the bull run were making too quick of a decision as far as who they would partner with. And I mean, this is a long road, right? Like, especially when you're selecting early stage investor that is going to be on your board and so on. So just take your time, you know, spend the time to really get to know the person, really get to know the firm, understand their point of view, and make sure that there is alignment, and then also understanding how they can actually be helpful in a tangible way. Because the challenge for founders, which I truly empathize with, is that, a lot of VCs say the same things. So it's really tough to parse out other than just selecting based on brand or whatever, which sometimes is the right decision, but not always. It's really hard to parse out, you know, who can really be helpful in for their specific company. That's the other thing, right? Like, I do think that this is, you know, very much matchmaking, and there's multiple factors that apply, not just, you know, the most known largest fund is, multiple things that I would encourage founders to take into account.
Right on. It's great advice. Well, last section here, a little quick hitter, rapid fire Q&A. If you're ready, we'll jump in.
Let's do it.
All right. What is the number one thing where you're evaluating a founder on within this ecosystem?
Deep industry insight, knowing something others don't, and having a clear point of view on how to apply technology to solve, you know, that problem or drive an order of magnitude improvement in their industry.
Could not agree more on the domain experience for sure. One resource could be book, podcast, blog, whatever you're reading, watching, you'd recommend the audience to follow in the ecosystem.
I really like the Science Magazine podcast. It's a little bit geeky, but the format is, you know, very concise, and usually learn a lot from hearing that podcast, listening to that podcast. Other than that, I would say we spend, or at least I personally spend, a lot of time talking to founders and operators. I find that that is bar none the best source of industry knowledge.
Awesome. Well, who's one person who should be on the podcast to help us keep building an ecosystem around these underserved industries?
I'll give you two, a founder and investor. So as far as founders, Akash Nandi, he's the founder of a company called Tendrell. They're building labor optimization for the agriculture industry. And then it extends beyond that to a really interesting system of record play. I think it would be great. And then Zach Fredericks at Primary Venture Partners. I'm not sure if you had him already, but if you haven't, I think he would be very insightful as far as supply chain and logistics investing.
Yeah, now they just pulled Zach over from LoadSmart. I think it's where he was before. He's definitely helping bring that supply chain DNA. So great suggestion there on both fronts. And then finally, Esteban, who's the best or best way for folks to reach out to you after the show?
Yeah, easy. ER@zenda.vc.
Right on. Make it super simple for them. Well, hey, appreciate you coming on, sharing a little bit about the new firm, you know, this LATAM theme you and I are both passionate about. I know it's not just LATAM, but we got a lot of opportunity that I think because of that prepared mind and honestly, a lot of the challenges that even back to your family's roots in coal mining, right? We got to get this right. So I'm excited to partner with you, Esteban, and thanks for coming on.
Likewise, Ty. Thanks a lot, and congrats on everything.